Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of novelist and short story writer Nathaniel Hawthorne. Born in Salem, Massachusetts, Hawthorne's paternal ancestors were some of the first Puritans to arrive in America. One of his ancestors was even a judge who oversaw the Salem witch trials. He was educated at Bowdoin College, where he became friends with poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and future President Franklin Pierce, among others. His first novel, Fanshawe, was published anonymously in 1828, followed by several collections of short stories, including Twice Told Tales and Moses from an Old Manse. His later novels include The Scarlet Letter, The House of the Seven Gables, The Blithedale Romance, and The Marble Faun. For this episode, we are joined by our friends at the House of Seven Gables in Salem, a museum and settlement house that preserves Hawthorne's birthplace while providing support for local immigrant communities. Our guests are Dakota Russell, Executive Director, and David Moffitt, Visitor Services Specialist and Researcher. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Dakota and David are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Exhibits Manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place January 10th, 2025, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Dakota and David, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm quite looking forward to talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne with you both and getting your inside perspectives on that. First, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves and your relation to Hawthorne? Dakota, maybe you can get us started.
Sure. I'm Dakota Russell. I'm the executive director here at the House of the Seven Gables. So our organization is obviously very entwined with Hawthorne in a big way. We were founded in 1910, and we preserved the Turner Ingersoll Mansion, which was the home of Susanna Ingersoll and the inspiration for the House of the Seven Gables in Hawthorne's book. And so we tell a little bit of that story here. And then we also preserve the Hawthorne birthplace, which was moved to the property in 1958.
Thank you.
And I'm David Moffitt, and I encountered Hawthorne first, I think, where most Americans do, which is in high school English class. But we read The Scarlet Letter. I think it was my senior year, and I really did enjoy it. And I think a lot of my classmates did not. He's definitely a writer that creates strong feelings on both sides, I think. But I continued to be interested in him in college, studying English, and then once I started working here, I've worked my way through all of his published writings and read a lot of his unpublished things too. So I've been very steeped in Hawthorne for a while.
Did you read The House of the Seven Gables before you worked here?
I didn't, but funnily enough, that was my mom's favorite book she read in high school. So she was trying to get me to read it before I started working here, and then I ended up working here. So
I did not read it until I had to interview for this position. But once I read it, I really loved it. It is probably still my favorite of his books.
I love that. Yeah. Had you encountered his work else prior to the other work?
Very similar to David's experience. I had read The Scarlet Letter as an assignment. I think that's how most people encounter The Scarlet Letter, which I'll also argue is maybe not the best way to encounter any book. And then I'd also read over the course of the time, sort of the major short stories, Young Goodman Brown and so forth. But I am from the Missouri Ozarks originally, and so Hawthorne doesn't have quite a hold on the culture further out west than as he does here, it was never something that we read a lot of.
Yeah, I should say I'm from just outside of Salem, so mm-hmm. Hawthorne is a big figure in the literary landscape here.
Yeah, I read all of Twain.
That is interesting. A thing I hadn't thought of, the regionality of these great American authors and writers, but where they lived and existed, it's still to this day they hold more importance perhaps than the rest of the country. That's an interesting, which I did like. And speaking of that, we mentioned a little bit prior to starting the interview, but in a town like Salem that has been around for a very long time, You mentioned how you can walk these streets and you know that Hawthorne also walked them and get the lay of the land and the geography. What's it like working for an organization as you do in the city in which the writer also is perhaps most tied to of his towns that he lived in? What's that feeling like as you're looking at all of the historical documents and David, like you said, even unpublished works, as you're also existing in this city as it is today. What does that feel like for you guys?
There's a certain power to it, I think, to be in Nathaniel Hawthorne's birthplace and read a Hawthorne story while you're, back in the day when I would be sitting in the rooms, the galleries, watching tourists and there's nobody there. You pull open a book and read some Hawthorne and, there's something kind of interesting that like maybe he's there, kindly watching or unhappily watching you read his work. And then, the House of the Seven Gables it's a beautiful structure and really well decorated in its own right. And then to have this idea too that parts of it look as Hawthorne would have known it, makes for a really interesting picture in your head when you read the novel because it's not a one-to-one like the novel definitely. And he makes a point that it's he's building castle in the air rather than in the county of Essex is how he says it. But you read the novel and you visit the house, or you visit the house and then you read the novel, it really colors your perception of both.
I think what's interesting is that most people don't necessarily get that experience from Salem today. You know, we come into it with a lot of sort of Hawthorne knowledge and so forth. But I think when people were coming to our site, you know, in 1910, 1920, up for most of the 20th century, they probably came with sort of that text in their mind, right? Because they had read a lot of Hawthorne. And I think since he is sort of starting to slip out of canon, right? Most of our guests that we see at the museum today really haven't read much Hawthorne, and it's frankly not the reason that most people come to Salem, Massachusetts anymore. That has a lot more to do with witch trials and Halloween, right? Is what people think of, and I think that's really what we're trying to do in our reimagining of Hawthorne's birthplace into a really dedicated Hawthorne Museum and put a new exhibit there, is to realize that people aren't coming with all that context. And so it falls on us to kind of be the central place to start them out from and then let them loose on the streets to go experience it, right? And, you know, hopefully let them loose in the pages of his books as well.
Yeah, well said. Can you talk a little bit about more about that that exhibition you just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have been undertaking for the last couple of years here a real big project to turn Nathaniel Hawthorne's birthplace. As I said, it was moved here in 1958 because it was threatened in its original location. Since that time, it has more or less been set up as kind of a furnished historic house museum, which doesn't touch a lot on Hawthorne. It's got pieces of it, and we know his connections, but and we have some artifacts in there, but we really want to bring those out, give those artifacts kind of a power of place and tell a story, realizing that, you know, it's not enough to just be in the birthplace for a lot of people because they don't have the context to make that special. And so we want to make that special for them by telling a little bit about Hawthorne and his life. And so we're designing a new exhibit for him for it that really will be an experience where you encounter artifacts, where you encounter interpretation, where you encounter multimedia presentations as you move through the house that give you a sense of who Hawthorne was and what inspired his work, and most importantly, how he's connected to Salem and rooted in New England and this place that's around you right now. And like I say, I think the main goal here is really to give people that idea of who Hawthorne was that's going to inspire them to seek out more.
Yeah, that's great.
Did I miss anything, David?
No, that was great. The thing about Hawthorne and Salem that I always try and keep in mind is Salem is not a place that Hawthorne really liked. It's where he was from, and it shaped him more than any other place. But that metaphor I use sometimes is, Salem was Wall Street, and Concord is Greenwich Village. that he leaves this place of like worldly gain and capitalism and moves to like the quiet area of artists and thinkers. And it's a very conscious choice he makes, but he comes back to Salem several times in his lifetime.
Well, we were joking a couple of months ago of Hawthorne as the first millennial graduates college and is forced to move back into his parents' attic. It's not going to be the best experience of his life.
There's a letter his friend from college, Horatio Bridge, wrote to him right around the time he had published Twice Told Tales and was like, you got to get out of Salem. Like, that place is sapping you of your, you know, of your passion. And it's, you know, this is not the place for you. You got to get out of there.
But the thing is, like, Salem sticks with him in the work, too, right? Yeah. It's like he can't escape it, even if he tries to physically. It's still, like, what he's thinking about.
Yeah. And so many of his best stories, like Young Goodman Brown, are Salem-based.
Salem stories.
Yeah, you can take the man out of Salem, but you can't take Salem out of the man, right? Is that how it goes? And actually now is a good time, I think, to maybe give our listeners a little bit of that, the history, if you will, or biography of when he was alive and then more so when he was most actively writing. If you could give a brief bio, because I know his family were in Salem or, you know, the Massachusetts colony from the beginning, right?
Yeah, so his lineage goes way back, which is something he writes about in his introduction to the Scarlet Letter.
Mm-hmm.
So his paternal ancestors had been in Salem since the 1630s. His father is born right around the time of the American Revolution, which is a war that his grandfather fought in. And he is born in 1804 in Salem, in the Nathaniel Hawthorne birthplace, as we know it today. Born on the 4th of July, which is very appropriate for an author who's so linked to America and its independence. And he goes to college in Maine at Bowdoin, which turns out to be very fortuitous for him because he meets Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who later becomes, you know, the great American poet of the age. And he meets Franklin Pierce, who later becomes president. He returns to Salem, and in that period, he starts his writing life. His first novel, Fanshawe, he publishes anonymously right around the time he graduates from college. It's sort of a Sir Walter Scott-influenced romance, adventure story, and he was quite ashamed of it. In fact, later in life, he denied having wrote it to his publisher, but it really shows the beginning of Hawthorne as a writer as we know him. And then over the next decade, he's, you know, 10, 12 years, he's writing anonymous stories and sketches, tries a few times to collect them into a collection of short stories with a frame narrative that never really pans out, but he's not putting his own name to it. They're appearing in these gift books that people buy to give to friends at Christmas and in magazines and newspapers. Even some local Salem newspapers publish a few of his stories. And then finally, 1837, he puts them together as the Twice Told Tales, where he picks, I think, 18 of those stories and republishes them under his own name. And that really puts him into the literary conversation in America. Longfellow writes a review of Twice Told Tales. Poe writes a review of Twice Told Tales. I was actually just found the other day, Boston newspaper from 1837, right after Twice Told Tales was published, says there are three great American writers named Nat. Nathaniel Parker Willis, somebody I think that's completely forgotten whose name I forget now, and then Nathaniel Hawthorne. And they say, you know, he just wrote one book, but I think he's going to be the best of all, basically. Is what they say.
Wow.
And so he's already in the conversation.
That's very Boston center of the universe.
And he then writes some more short stories. He collects those as Mosses from an Old Manse, which is where you get Young Goodman Brown there are some of his famous stories in Twice Told Tales. And then it's really 1850 that is the start of really the big decade for defining American literature in the American Renaissance. And it starts with Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. And then he follows it up with The House of the Seven Gables the next year, follows it up with the Blithedale Romance. He spends most of the 1850s in Europe because of his connections with Pierce. He gets a nice job in England as a diplomat. And then he writes his final published novel, The Marble Faun, in 1860. He writes a collection of essays about life in England called Our Old Home. He writes an essay for the Atlantic Monthly, chiefly about war matters, about the Civil War, and he dies in 1864, just 59. And so a very short writing life with a long shadow in American literature.
Yeah, well, that's a great way to put it, yeah. And I like how you mentioned that that American Renaissance time and really kind of defining what the American literary voice will be, and all his contemporaries too that you mentioned, like Poe, Longfellow, and in my research I found Herman Melville was a big fan of his, and Hawthorne, you know, he's neighbors with Thoreau and Emerson, and Bronson Alcott. Like, I'm curious if you have any insights into how these, who we know now as, the ones who are on their high school syllabus for American Lit, like, and they're all living and existing in the same place at the same time. I'm curious if there was any sort of like shared ideas, or if you know of any ways in which they influence each other's writing or thinking.
Well, I think this one is one of the ones that in the new exhibit we're really trying to take on, is this idea that, Hawthorne somewhat promoted himself of like this character of who he was, of this sort of solitary, broody writer, right? Mm-hmm. But one thing we really know about him is that there was a lot of interaction with these other writers, both the ones that were close to him here in Massachusetts that he saw run on a regular basis, but he was also corresponding with a lot of other writers as well, and that they were really reading each other, thinking about each other, gifting each other, books, and they were really working toward kind of shaping this American voice. And I think one of the things that I've learned through this process is just how much the world was sort of looking at them to say, okay, what are Americans like, right? What do they care about and what matters to them? And so it's really interesting sort of that you see these people coming through it, some of these writers that are looking at it through, a social lens, like Thoreau, nature, Emerson and Thoreau both, Melville thinking about, sort of man's relationship with nature and with the wilderness there. And I think a lot of people were watching, which is really interesting. But I mean, can you think of any specifics? I went really vague there.
Yeah, no, I think he was not himself a transcendentalist, mm-hmm. which is something that a lot of people confuse, because he was friends with all of the major transcendentalists, and he spent some time in a transcendentalist commune even at Brook right. Farm. But he was much more skeptical of that movement, of that philosophy. It was very utopian, very optimistic, and Hawthorne in a lot of ways is pretty cynical and pessimistic, especially when it comes to human nature in a broader frame. But he found a lot of common ground with Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller, who was feminist writer and transcendentalist at the time, with Herman Melville, that they had these similar ideas, even if he didn't subscribe to transcendentalism as a philosophy, about individualism and the place of people in society and nature, as Dakota was saying, and really like forming what America is and mm-hmm. like this is the period that America is starting to really step out on the world stage as an artistic and cultural power. And he's one of the people that's really defining that, as are a lot of his friends or acquaintances.
And I think you touched on something that's really important about him too, is that he hangs out and is influenced by all of these people that challenge him. Yeah. Like, they don't think the same that he does. He does not surround himself with necessarily like-minded people, but he really gets a lot from these people, even when he doesn't agree with them. You know, he likes to look at the world through different eyes.
Yeah. And that makes me think a little bit about going back to his family's history and the Puritan influence, and, you know, the other themes in his work that are perhaps kind of like fighting against that like single-minded approach to the world, right? To living. Or would you say that is a running theme? I'm trying to figure out how to get this question. Like
I think you see the push and pull of him thinking about lots of things like that when you go into it. You know, the House of the Seven Gables is really interesting because, you know, it's about the role that history should play in our lives. And I think it's interesting to us in the history business because Hawthorne is a great lover of history and a great reader of history. But the book on its surface is very anti-history, right? Mm. It's very much about, you know, we can't be shackled by history. We've got to build something new, you know? And so you see that push and pull in his writing. And I think that's true of religion as well. You know, he's hanging out with a lot of these sort of free-minded folks who are like, we've got to invent our own ethical systems and so forth. But Hawthorne himself is, even though he sees like the damage that Christianity can do and writes about it, you know, and sort of the Scarlet Letter and, you know, how you can get caught up in dogma and how it can drag you down here. You know, he remains a very, you know, religious and Christian guy throughout most of his life there. And that's evident in his writing as well. He's not necessarily afraid to contradict himself.
Yeah. Well, and I think another big theme that runs through his work is a skepticism of authority and the idea of the artist as someone standing aside from society and often transforming the things they get from society, the you know, aspersions of society, transforming that into art. And he's friends with Henry David Thoreau, but he's not, you know, writing Civil Disobedience. He's writing The Scarlet Letter instead. Uh-huh. And, you know, and in his own life is a very sort of conservative, cynical person when it comes to the big social movements of his day. But here he is, you know, going fishing with Henry David Thoreau, and they're probably having long conversations about, you know, society and people's place in it.
Yeah. So we're talking about his contemporaries, you know, writers who he knew at the same time when he was writing. I'm curious if either of you know about any writers within history that he was fond of, like American or otherwise, like his reading habits. Do you know of any insights into that?
Yeah, we know he was a big reader, especially as a child. He was from a family that was fairly literary. His older sister was also a very intellectual literary person. And so through the recollections of his sister and some of Hawthorne's own recollections and his library, you know, checkouts and things, we know that he was a big fan of a lot of the canon of English literature. He loved Milton. He loved Shakespeare. He loved Edmund Spenser and John Bunyan, both of whom, as writers of allegory, really played into his later writing style. A lot of critics have seen Milton's Paradise Lost and the Satan figure in that and the fall of Eve and all that as having a long, you know, part of Hawthorne's writing as well. He loved the English Romantic poets. He was reading a lot of French writers like Voltaire and others from the Enlightenment. And he was reading Gothic literature too, which really influenced a lot of his short stories and The House of the Seven Gables, so Anne Radcliffe, Horace Walpole, the American Charles Brockden Brown, and a guy named John Neal, who was a huge figure in American literature when Hawthorne was starting to write, but who's been eclipsed by Hawthorne in the canon.
Interesting. Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, and maybe this is too broad of a question, but I was thinking on the other side of it, like what writers of today can you think of that have been inspired by Hawthorne, or is it perhaps too many to number at this point?
It's, It's too many to number. It's, you know, I think all writers of short stories in America, whether they realize it or not, are following in a tradition that Hawthorne created with Poe and Washington Irving. And the line really follows. I mean, he is the American canon at the end of the 1800s. James Fenimore Cooper, you know, in Hawthorne's lifetime really had that position. But I think his star faded a bit. And it was Henry James and William Dean Howells in the 1870s and 80s who elevated Hawthorne. They saw him as the romantic writer that was the most real. And so as realism really took over the American literary scene, he survived.
Interesting.
And all of these writers that we think of as like the great writers of his day, like Melville and Whitman and Dickinson, like most of them weren't appreciated until the modernists came along in the 20s. And so he was the American figure to look to. And so you see it, a lot of Southern Gothic lit. I mean, he's one of the most Yankee writers, but Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, Carson McCullers, they all are drawing on Hawthorne. And then he's also, I think, one of the first postmodernists, like Emerson's friend Thomas Carlyle, who wrote Sartor Resartus. You have The Marble Faun, which is a novel very much about art and the relationship between representation and real life, the model and the painting, the story and the telling of it. Hawthorne inserts himself as a character in the end of the novel. So a lot of postmodernists have really drawn on him. Like, and so Paul Auster, whose New York trilogy really draws on Hawthorne and several of the other American romantics. But you have even like John Updike wrote a trilogy of novels recasting The Scarlet Letter. Yeah. Susan Lloyd Parks wrote plays called the Red Letter Plays that brought the Scarlet Letter into contemporary American life. So, I mean, a lot of writers have drawn on Hawthorne. There, he has his critics in the canon. Mark Twain was not a big fan. More contemporary, I know Jane Smiley and Donna Tartt and Margaret Atwood have all had jabs at Hawthorne in the mouths of their characters or in literary criticism that they've done. And so he is a writer that, you know, sometimes like he's not found as much influence, I think, with American women writers as with men, partly because of his own sexism in some of his writings. But there are also American writers who found really feminist themes in The Scarlet Letter and drawn those into the present and things. So he's a man of contradictions, but his influence is so vast that you can't.
Well, I think when we talk about popular fiction, you know, there's a huge influence of Hawthorne on the fiction that we read today, right? When we talk about genre fiction, I feel like he doesn't necessarily get enough credit as sort of the godfather of saying it's okay to play around and do a science fiction story over here and a horror story over here, and we're going to try this out. You know, he does a lot of experimenting and a lot of sort of establishing, you know, kind of this weird fiction that's going to go on and inspire Lovecraft and the like in the one direction, but, you know, inspiring this very literary fiction in the other way. I think Wonder Book for Boys and Girls and Tanglewood Tales is sort of the first retelling of the Greek myths for young adult and audience there. Really, you can't discount the influence on sort of the way that that's been picked up and run, retelling these old stories, you know, with fiction for kids ever since, really.
And I think Americans, when they picture the myth of Midas or Pegasus or Pandora's box, they're really thinking about Hawthorne's retellings of them.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think like most kids, you know, you, and maybe this is just me. I mean, I say most kids and hope that it's not just me. You know, you're reading those Greek myths as a kid. And I didn't really realize that because obviously it wasn't the Hawthorne I was reading. But the Greek myths that I was reading as a kid had a lot more in common with Hawthorne than they did with any actual Greek text.
I should mention, too, Jhumpa Lahiri, wrote a novel, Unaccustomed Earth, that takes its epigraph and its name from a Hawthorne quote. And so, you know, if you start to look, you'll find his influence all over contemporary American literature.
Yeah, I think he's so baked in that some people don't even realize that he's an influence. He's been adopted and recycled and so forth for so many generations.
Yeah, baked in is a good way to put it. Yeah, it's almost unnoticeable because it's...
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, he is sadly underread, or that, you know, people don't think about him in the same way that they think about Edgar Allan Poe, who has sort of this one thing that he can... that people hang around it, right? And say, okay, well, he's the guy who did this, you know? And Hawthorne does like all of these things, and he's very interested in getting involved in all of the different levels all over the place, and just does so much that's just accepted and not thought about now, that even though he's not as widely read, he's had this tremendous impact.
Yeah.
And I think he's a writer that suffered from being read shallowly more than, you know, a lot of Americans read The Scarlet Letter or some of his short stories. But I know a lot of tourists that I've talked to over the, you know, time that I've worked here say that it was mostly just talking about like A to B symbolism, you know, what does the color red mean in The Scarlet Letter? And like not really exploring some of the deeper themes and like some of the deeper parts of what makes literature literature, that it often is sort of a very basic exercise. And so I think a lot of people are turned off from Hawthorne because of that too.
Ask anybody who had to read Young Goodman Brown for a college literature class how much they hate those pink ribbons.
Yes.
yeah
because I mean, you look at the Young Goodman Brown and like you could talk about the pink ribbon, which is clearly a symbol. Yeah. But you could also talk about how, you know, the fact that is it a dream or is it reality? And both of those interpretations have a big, you know, impact on the story. They both, does the difference really matter to Hawthorne and like how it, what it says about hypocrisy and society? And, you know, if you spend too much time talking about what the pink ribbon means, you lose some of the deeper meanings.
Yeah. And it's not one that's easy to like turn into sort of an easy moral story either when you go down to it and be like, this is what Hawthorne was trying to say here. He contradicts himself 9 or 10 times over the course of that story and what he thinks about the plot and the characters and so forth.
It's making me think too, like, you know, if you were, say, teaching Hawthorne in a class, how would you present him to students in a way that's like, this is why you should read him today? Of course, we can learn literary techniques and things, but I'm wondering if there's anything in his work that you think perhaps speaks to our current moment. For me, I think of technology changes decades past, but the human story is still the human story. And I think he was tackling things that are psychological things and feelings that perhaps don't go away depending on whatever era you're in. So I'm curious if you have any, you know, why would you recommend people read Nathaniel Hawthorne today?
Yeah, I think he's interested in the human experience across time. I think you nailed something right then. You know, he was interested in the things that connected people from the 1600s to the people from the 1800s. Mm. And, you know, what could a contemporary audience find to identify with in sort of these histories that seem so far and so long ago today. I think for contemporary readers, one thing that really, I think, resonates in modern times or in the times we live in now is this idea of, he writes about a lot of people who are stuck, a lot of people who are trying to build new ways of living and new ways of being within a society with rules and restrictions that are still very upheld, but are slowly sort of falling apart, you know? And I think that's the way maybe a lot of people feel about 21st century American government and capitalism. And I think that Hawthorne really touches on, like, what can an individual do? And how can an individual find happiness in those places?
Yeah, and I think along the same lines that there's a heroism to standing up to society's ideas and visions, you know, of you. Sometimes that line between what is the public self and the private self and how they interact, the sense of projection too. You see it in The Scarlet Letter and some of his stories that, you know, those who are the loudest critics and the most, you know, quick to criticize others are often the most hypocritical, the most corrupt themselves. And then with The House of the Seven Gables specifically, I think it's an incredibly relevant story to our modern America because it's about what do you do with ill-gotten wealth and the incidents of the past that have happened generations before you're born, but how do you come to terms with the evil that was done in a previous generation, which as you're looking at America today and the submerged injustices that have existed long before any of us were alive, how does that impact how we live in our country and how we can move forward? And that's what The House of the Seven Gables is about as a novel.
And I mean, not to go too high-minded, but it's what we're about as an organization too. I didn't touch on it at the beginning, Nate, but our founder, Carolyn Emerton, was a big part of the progressive era and was an activist during that time. And so she really established us as a museum, but also as a settlement house at the same time, with our museum activities supporting our social work that we did, well, a lot of it with new immigrants who were arriving in America in the early 1900s there. And I think it's really interesting some of the interplay that has with the themes of the Gables too, the idea of folks coming in and new arrivals and new Americans trying to figure out how they wrestle with this, their own legacies, but also the legacy of this country.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that aspect of your organization's work too. I found that, just like you said, important work, A, but then B, the connections to the Gables and Hawthorne's work as well. And grappling with the, you know, his ancestors' pasts and what, you know, what do you do now? And speaking of now, what do you, if he were alive today, if you want to surmise, what do you think, you know, I'm sure he'd be creating some sort of writing. Do you think he'd be like, I don't know, do you think he'd have a public persona like on social media that was like, because you mentioned a little bit, like, you know, he sort of crafted his image. So I'm like, with all the tools, if you will, for lack of a better word, the social media now to do that, like, do you think he'd have a good Instagram page? What do you think? Would he be a podcaster too?
It's hard to say. I mean, he does have this self image of seclusion and separateness from the world. So whether he would be, you know, like a Thomas Pynchon-esque author, somebody made a good point. I can't remember where I was reading it, but they said Nathaniel Hawthorne and Franklin Pierce being best friends is like if Thomas Pynchon and Gerald Ford were like childhood best friends. Like, it's just such a strange.
That is.
But so, I mean, I was saying to Dakota before we started, like, I can't imagine if Hawthorne had Twitter, what kinds of takes he would have, or, you know, if he would even weigh in. If he would even have social media or be somebody that sort of set himself apart from that. I think would travel. That's something he would love about the world today is that how much easier it is to travel and explore. He did a little bit of traveling domestically as a young man and then in Europe when he was older, but he tried to join an expedition to explore the globe in the 1830s, but didn't manage to make the cut. But,
oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think he's the guy that's morally opposed to Elon Musk, but can't quit Twitter.
But as we're wrapping up here, I did wanted to give a I know you have some excerpts of Hawthorne to read. I think now would be a good time. And I'm curious to hear why you chose the Given piece as well. That's always a fascinating aspect to me.
Okay. So this is from The House of the Seven Gables. And as a quick setup, you have a character named Holgrave, who's a daguerreotypist. And so he makes early photographs, which are very portrait-like, sort of this continuum of an old art being surpassed by new technology. And he is a boarder living in the attic of the House of the Seven Gables because the family is now having a lot of financial problems. And he's talking to Phoebe, who is the sunny young cousin from the country who's come to live in the house. And he's talking to Phoebe about history. And he says, "Shall we never, never get rid of this past?" cried he, keeping up the earnest tone of his preceding conversation. "It lies upon the present like a giant's dead body. In fact, the case is just as if a young giant were compelled to waste all his strength in carrying about the corpse of the old giant, his grandfather, who died a long while ago and only needs to be decently buried. Just think a moment, and it will startle you to see what slaves we are to bygone times. To death, if we must give the matter the right word." "But I do not see it," observed Phoebe. "For example, then," continued Holgrave, "a dead man, if he happens to make a will, disposes of wealth no longer his own, or if he die intestate, it is distributed in accordance with the notions of men much longer dead than he. A dead man sits in all our judgment seats, and living judges do but search out and repeat his decisions. We read in dead men's books, we laugh at dead men's jokes, and cry at dead men's pathos. We are sick of dead men's diseases, physical and moral, and die of the same remedies with which dead doctors killed their patients. We worship the living deity according to dead men's forms and creeds. Whatever we seek to do of our own free motion, a dead man's icy hand obstructs us. Turn our eyes to what point we may, a dead man's white, immitigable face encounters them and freezes our very heart. And we must be ourselves dead before we can begin to have our proper influence on our own world, which will then be no longer our world, but the world of another generation, with which we shall have no shadow of a right to interfere. I ought to have said, too, that we live in dead men's houses, as, for instance, in this of the Seven Gables."
Thank you for that, David.
Yeah. And so there's a lot there, but that idea of, you know, living in a world that is shaped by tradition in the past that we had no role in, and that we're going to create our own tradition, but it's not going to affect our world. It's going to affect those who come after us.
And I think what's really interesting is, like, Holgrave and Phoebe, you know, again, you get the sense that that's very anti-history, right?
Yeah.
And Holgrave's position is somewhat moderated by the end of the book, but yeah. It's about, he's feeling as a young man coming up, and Phoebe with him there, the idea of they're trapped from making anything new by history. But Hawthorne also has these two older characters, Clifford and Hepzibah, who are the inheritors of this old history and somewhat the gatekeepers of it. And they also feel trapped by it. They can't figure out a way to live in balance with it. And they sort of find a middle ground over the course of the novel, these four people, which I think is what makes it really special. I did bring along, just to sort of underscore contradictions in Hawthorne, which I feel like has become a theme through here, I brought along a quote from D.H. Lawrence about the House of the Seven Gables. "Oh, Nathaniel, you savage ironist. Ugh, how you'd have hated it if you had nothing but the prosperous, dear young couple to write about. If you lived to the day when America was nothing but a main street."
That is good. That's good, yes. I thank you both for collecting those and reading them. As we're getting close to the end here, was there anything about Hawthorne or your work that you're doing there in Salem that we hadn't touched on that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I think, you know, if I was to encourage folks to do anything, it's to jump in, read a little Hawthorne. There's The House of the Seven Gables, I always tell people, is daunting because it's a little bit of a shaggy dog story. You know, I think that's one of the fun things with Hawthorne, is that he's a very playful narrator. But if it's easier to start with the short stories, start with the short stories, and really get involved with those. And I definitely would encourage people to come seek out Salem and wander some of these streets and get a real sense of the places that Hawthorne was thinking about and writing about here. And obviously, once we are able to get this new exhibit and this new Hawthorne Museum opened in the birthplace, come and see us and learn a little bit more about his life and see some of the objects.
Yes, well said. And I can attest. So yeah, definitely check that out if you're ever in Massachusetts or New England. David, Dakota, thank you again for joining me today. I had a blast and look forward to sharing this and hearing more about the new museum and exhibition you're working on.
Yeah, thanks so much, Nate. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.